Serve It Cold, Episode 8. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
Right, So Tommy's got one eye on the store and one on this ratty, beat-up old Bonneville for Johnny C. Yeah, you know him. Worked with Big John Turner. Yeah, that's our Johnny. So Tommy's keeping an eye on the skanky car to see if its skanky owners show back up. Have you not been listening? Jerry and Ray, the two crankheads that kidnapped the girl. No, I'm not going to tell you who she is, so quit asking. Where was I? Oh, yeah. Lo and behold, shuffling down the street, barefoot and shirtless, comes this scrawny ass pimple. He's got these stylish purple hip huggers on. Only problem is, the boy is no judge of a good fit. The legs are about a foot too long and dragging in the finest mixture of quarter street grime, and he's got no ass, so the jeans are trying to migrate south for the winter. So he's got them rolled up and his thumbs hitched through a belt loop. But wait, it gets better. He doesn't have the keys. He can't get in. Yes. Yes. After he gives up beating on the doors and windows and walks off, and you're going to love this part, a tow truck spots the ticket on the window and tows it off, lock, stock, and peeling vinyl. That's when Tommy called Johnny and then me. You better believe he wouldn't want the cops rifling through that trunk either. No, I don't have any idea where the other one was. Might have gone back to Catherine. Can't you just picture the look on this guy's face when he comes back and that car is gone?
My cell phone rang. Tommy again. I could actually see him standing in his door watching the tow truck and its captive Bonneville turn the corner two blocks from him. I answered, Yeah, we saw it. Did you get the towing company name?
Company name, phone number, and truck number.
Super sleuth. That's great. If we have to go hunt this thing down again, now we'll know where to start. Please write it down, and I'll grab it later.
Already done. Why don't you all come down around 5:30?
It's a date. Bye. While I had the phone out, I decided to check in on the home front. Lurker 76 and Gojo had cleared another 4 missing persons cases since I'd left Catherine. I told Gojo, I'm glad someone's making money this week. So far, all I'm doing is spending it. Any other messages?
Let's see. Call Goat. Call Goat. Call Goat. Call Goat. Did you or did you not give that man your cell phone number?
He's not wanting to bother me while I'm working. Tell him I'll call him after dark.
Well, next time you leave town, tell Mr. Goat not to bother me while I'm working either.
Gojo, I think I'll leave that telling to you. Be my guest.
On second thought, I'm honored to be taking Mr. Goat Johnson's messages. Hey, he told me Narlene's all right. Good work, see? Here's more. Dr. Landis Grantham has called almost as many times as Goat, wanting to know if the case is progressing.
Tell him I've made contact and I'm making good progress in the case.
Good. That's just what I told him last time he called. I also said you expect to be back in town on Thursday. By the way, you told me all this about 3:00.
Good. I'm getting down to fishing, aren't I?
B&E have been by twice today. They're scaring Bebop to death, and he has asked me to pass on his great concern for your health, as well as your mother's health, or words to that effect.
He warms my heart. Tell him that.
About Homer. I think he's run out of BBs. He still stalks by every once in a while, flashing his little puppy gang hand signs and look like he's going to trip on his lower lip.
Gigi been bothering you?
Nah, I think Vera took care of him, somehow.
Good. I imagine he's just taking a vacation from bitching while I'm gone. Would you give Vera a ring and tell her I'm still alive and I'll call her after dark, too?
Sure. We're holding down the fort up here while you're whining and dining Miss Congeniality in the Big Easy.
No, Miss Hospitality to you, my young man.
Oh, I see. Well, I totally apologize for casting any aspersions real or imagined, your way, boss. I'm real, C. Don't you get in trouble down there.
Who, me? What makes you think that I would get in trouble in New Orleans? I'll talk to you later, Gojo. About 30 minutes dwindled away as the band was getting into the meat of its repertoire, and the musicians were really having fun. An unmarked car pulled into the no-parking zone just riverside of the Royal and Toulouse corner. Four immaculately dressed tourists got out of the car at once. I turned and called in a loud whisper,
"Arlene! Cops!"
I pointed down to the car.
"They may have already popped the trunk of the Bonneville and found something interesting."
She pulled her chair close to mine.
"Where?"
I pointed to the four guys individually as they spread out from the car.
"How do you know?"
I shrugged and continued sotto voce.
"Where they parked, how they're dressed, how they're acting, the matching Ray-Bans. Or it could be that they're all wearing earpieces and microphones clipped to their Izod shirts."
She looked closely at the dispersing quartet, nodding her head. She looked back to me.
"And why in the hell are we whispering, Johnny C?"
"Have you noticed how well you can hear people talking on the street? You'll really be able to tell it later when the crowds thin out. Sometimes you can actually hear someone whispering when they're standing at our front door. The sounds bounce back and forth between these buildings. Well, I always wondered if the acoustics work the other way too. I figure better safe than sorry."
"What are they doing?"
"Maybe looking for Jerry or Ray. Someone on the street might have noticed Jerry pounding on the car. We'll see."
They were sure looking for someone. They drifted into position, two uptown of the intersection, and the crowd gathered around the street band, one on either side of the street. Two went to the downtown side of the crowd. They all had a bad case of swivel neck. The musicians had spotted the cops by now and were exchanging looks and nods back and forth. If things went bad, the band would already have made a plan for protecting instruments, the day's bank, and the fast exits of any members who might have serious law trouble. The scene was like watching an African wildlife documentary. Lions on the prowl, the nervous herd of waterbuck at the waterhole, hypervigilant. The cop nearest us stepped under our building's second floor balcony. I motioned for Narlene to listen up, and sure enough, I began to separate his words from the noise of the street.
No. Nothing behind us. There. Yellow bandana."
I poked my head further out of the window and spotted a scruffy-looking, at least as scruffy as me, guy with a bright new yellow bandana tied to his head. He was wearing a blue windbreaker with a large red Z logo on the front, in the 80-degree heat. I drew closer to Narlene and spoke even softer.
"I think they're looking for a pickpocket team. See the guy with the yellow bandana? He's the distraction. He'll bump the target while the talent lifts the package. If there's a commotion, he'll be around the corner, throw the bandana and the jacket in a trash can, and be able to walk right back around here with nobody recognizing him."
"Can't he see the cops?"
"Maybe. If he does, he'll just walk away. But Big John Turner and I have watched the cops catch plenty of people before from right here. If Yellowhead there is too focused on his job, he'll become mesmerized and forget to be watchful."
I looked back up just in time to see Latimer and Willie Banks Grantham walk down Royal and disappear right under the same second-story balcony that was shielding the cop from our view. I listened hard for their voices, but it seemed that now I had tuned the cop's voice in, I couldn't separate out any others. After a while, the couple appeared walking uptown toward their hotel. Once again, they seemed to be looking for something, strolling right through the Pride of Lions, oblivious but invisible. Such is life on the Louisiana Veldt. I saw Narlene had noticed me watching the Granthams. I thought of them that way now. A couple, separated by marriage and joined by infidelity. The Granthams.
"Do you recognize them?"
She took a few seconds to consider.
"No. Are they pickpockets too?"
"No. They just look familiar. I think they're from Catherine."
I raised my camera and took a few pictures of the couple walking hand in hand. Narlene gave a puzzled look but didn't say anything. I continued, snapping some shots of the band and the street scene in the hard afternoon light before settling back down to watching the hunt. Between songs, people would step from the crowd and throw money into an open guitar case. an act of goodwill that gave Yellowhead and his accomplice looks at wallets as well as their hiding places. A couple of songs went by before Yellowhead made eye contact with someone across the way and started giving signals like a third base coach, coughing, rubbing an ear. I swung my attention around, trying to find someone staring back across the crowd toward Yellowhead. Try as I might, I couldn't pick anyone out. Then I heard the cop below me barking into his microphone.
Got her! Right at the barricade! Young girl, dark baseball cap, olive sweatshirt.
I pulled out my binoculars, scanned the crowd, and found her this time. She seemed very young, maybe 12, 13. She was working the opposite setup as Yellowhead. Her cap, sweatshirt, and sweatpants were charity store olive drab. Her hair, completely hidden by the cap, she was slight and short. She was completely part of the crowd. After she made her pick, even if there was trouble, she would walk in the opposite direction while all the attention would be drawn to Yellowhead. She could duck into a hole and shuck out to bright purple or blue hair, ripped tank top, maybe a tartan mini skirt, thigh highs. Okay, maybe my fantasy life is showing just a bit here. The thing is, she could quickly turn invisible by being very visible. I tried to point the girl out to Narlene, but she just couldn't find the nondescript body in the crowd. As the song ended, the cop below us got excited again.
Okay, everybody, they're going for it. Let's go.
First at a walk, then at a trot, the lions closed on their prey. Yellowhead and the girl came toward each other. Then suddenly, the girl stopped dead with both hands directly in front of her, palms out. She then raised one hand to the bill of her cap, as if to shield her vision from the sinking sun. She hopped up and down and waved to someone across the crowd. She shouted something. Maybe a name? I turned back to Yellowhead, and he wasn't there. I had a 50-foot height advantage on the pride of cops, and used it. I stood up and leaned closer to find Yellowhead kneeling, as if tying a shoelace. When he rose, the bandana and the blue jacket were gone. He turned and walked slowly downtown on Royal, now carrying a Dansk shopping bag. I could no longer hear the cop below since he had walked out into the street, but the pride's confusion was evident as they looked in all directions for Yellowhead. I turned back to the girl and she was gone too. As I tried to catch Narlene up on the action below, I scanned back and forth across the crowd. Then the next song cranked up, and I saw her emerge from the crowd headed toward the river on Toulouse. No thigh highs. She was still dressed in olive drab, but she soon slipped the hat off and shook out a thick mop of hair that was indeed bright blue. As she passed in front of NOLA USA, blue hair girl threw her hat into a garbage can with her right hand, and with her left hand threw something behind the can. I picked up the binoculars and zoomed in. An open wallet lay against the wall of the building. She had already made the pick before she held up her hands, probably just as people had started forward to leave tips, jostling in the crowd. I wondered if Yellowhead had done the same on his side of the crowd. Today, on the Louisiana Veldt, the lions would go hungry. The jackals would eat well tonight. The discarded wallet was just a bone-picked skeleton. I called Tommy. Hey, just behind the trash can outside your door is a wallet laying against the wall. It was just picked in the crowd on Royal. There's a plastic undercover cop 20 feet lakeside of your store, looking the wrong way, of course. You willing to show him the wallet? You can tell him you heard it hit the wall. Maybe the victim will have a chance of getting his license and pictures back.
Damn, Little John. What did we ever do for excitement before you decided to come home to the quarter? Have you got any murders we can solve after supper?
Not yet. I'll work on it.
Okay, I see it now. Later.
As we watched Tommy approach the officer, Narlene asked,
Won't the cop be mad that Tommy knows he's a cop? I mean, if he blows his cover?
No. Tommy probably knows him by his first name. The police in the quarter, in a way, really work for the shop owners. Their main job is to protect the tourists, and that includes protecting tourists from themselves. But they protect the tourists for the shop owners. Those are the people they see day in and day out. Their constituency. Now, Tommy is willing to actually walk away from his shop, which is really a big deal, even if it's only 20 feet. To leave his shop untended and talk to a cop. Not to do me a favor, but to help out a tourist. Tourists, you see, make up Tommy's constituency. It's a constituency that all quarter shop owners bitch about day in and day out to each other, but tourists provide them their livelihoods.
Okay, Johnny C. You're starting to sound like my sociology professor. Which I guess is fair, because that's the class I'm going to be skipping come 6:30.
She stretched and settled back in her chair. She didn't look like missing a sociology class was really bothering her. Below us, Tommy's discovery of the wallet convinced the pride of cops that their time of opportunity had truly passed. Three of them drifted downtown on Royal, while the fourth moved the car onto the next hunting zone. I carefully watched how the pride moved down the street. They had failed this afternoon, but they were still professionals, and damn good ones. Big John taught me that watching one good professional for 30 minutes was worth a month of high-priced detective seminars. Then I caught sight of Jerry Joachim walking against the flow of the pride. I burst out laughing. Narlene sat up quickly.
What?
I really like that turquoise blouse of yours, Narlene, and pointed down the street.
He didn't. That sorry son of a bitch.
Jerry was walking right down the middle of Royal. He was still barefooted, but he was now wearing a turquoise and metallic silver blouse that was too long in the arms, but way too tight to button over his bare chest. He had tied the purple hip huggers on with a white electrical extension cord. The two ends dangled below his crotch. I had the sobering thought that Jerry's fashion statement might catch on and damage the quarter for years. As he approached, the first cop spoke into his collar mic. The simultaneous jerk of the head from the other two cops told me their only interest in Jerry was for entertainment value. Jerry reached to loose, turned the corner, and stared down to the empty spot where the Bonneville had been. He quickly turned and looked up to loose toward Bourbon, then up at the street sign above him. His arms fell to his sides. He turned around and shuffled back down Royal, sleeves flapping, his pants cuffs dragging. "You've just got to feel sorry for the little fellow, Narlene."
"Sorry? That no good? Motherfucking son of a bitch! I'll show you the hell!"
She rose and stepped toward the balcony, her right hand raised. I thought I'd pushed this joke a little too far and jumped up to keep her from yelling at the departing Jerry. As soon as I touched her arm, she turned toward me, and the rage collapsed into laughter.
"I got you, Johnny C. I thought I'd gotten your attention the other day at the mini-mart. I'm not half as hot-headed as I put on."
"You more than got my attention. You made me a true believer. I don't ever want to make you mad at me again, half or whole." I glanced over the lip of the balcony as upturned faces backed into the street, looking for the source of the outburst. "Thank you, Narlene. I think you've answered my question about whether sound bounces down as well as it bounces up here." We quietly slid our chairs back from the windows. We watched the afternoon shadows stretch down the street in silence for a while. As 5 o'clock neared, the crowd below thinned. Musicians packed their instruments and gathered in a tight circle to count and divide the day's take. I imagined that somewhere Yellowhead and Bluehair Girl were doing the same. The banging sounds of the street barricades being put up were soon joined by sounds of shop owners closing up for the night. The streets took on an almost deserted look as the tourists filtered back to their hotel rooms with their purchases or into restaurants for early bird specials. The pedestrians were soon replaced by a steady stream of slow-moving cars heading uptown to Canal Street. Sunset was still an hour away, but the shadows had crawled up our side of the street to envelop us. We sat in the dark, which only heightened the dramatic light on the 200-year-old facades across from us. It was a good setting for remembering, and I sat locked in a waking dream, a collage crossing years of French Quarter memories.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where Is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at DancingCatStudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel-length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com. Episode 8 again featured the Hypnotics as our street band. You heard Planning an Accident, Death Letter Blues, The Blues Don't Know, and Get Up. The Hypnotics music can be found from the PodSafe Music Network, which is at music.podshow.com, or from their own site, which is scotteldridge.com. That's scotteldridge.com. And because we really like their music, we would like you to have a chance to listen to Death Letter Blues without having a lot of people talking over it.
I got a letter this morning. How do you? Reckon it read, said, hurry, hurry, the gal you love is dead. I got a letter this morning, how do you reckon it read? It said, hurry, hurry, son, because the gal you love is dead. So I grabbed up my suitcase, took off down the road. When I got there, girl was laid on the cooling board. Grabbed up my suitcase and took off down the road. Stretched out on the cooling board, right there. Looked like 10,000 people standing round the burying ground. Didn't know I loved that girl, no, not till they laid her body down. Looked like 10,000 people, and they were standing round the burying ground. I didn't know I loved that girl, not till they laid her body down.
back close, looked down in her face, said, "Farewell, baby, I'll be waiting on you judgment day." Walked up right close, I looked down in that poor girl's face. I just can't take your place. Well, woke up this morning at the break of day, just hugging that pillow where my baby used to lay. Yeah, yeah. Woke up this morning at the break of day. Baby used to lay. Well, well.